Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Georgine Rice. This week, with the Supreme Court looking at Mississippi's abortion law, Mississippi's Attorney General files a brief.
Mississippi has said, look, a lot has changed since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. Science has advanced, but our laws have not.
Is there really a chance we could see the court essentially overturn Roe?
I'm guardedly optimistic that this court's going to overturn Roe and Doe.
The CDC and the Biden administration press masks again for kids.
No one within the CDC will take credit or explain their reasoning.
Many parents have simply had enough.
There is a huge explosion in homeschooling.
All this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host. It's great to be with you again. I'm coming to you from Portland and my radio studio here at KPDQ. It's great to be back with you. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin with the Supreme Court. In May this year, the High Court agreed to take up a challenge to Mississippi's abortion law that would prohibit abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The fact that this court, a markedly more conservative Supreme Court, would take an abortion case was big news. Well, since they took the case, keen court watchers have been wondering, should we look for incremental progress on the abortion issue in this case, or should we look for the court to definitively overturn Roe? The attorney general from Mississippi made herself more than clear in a brief she just filed with the court. Kevin McCullough turned to Allison Chidofonte of Live Action from AM 570, The Mission in New York City.
It seems like an opportune time for the court to get a case like this. It seems like, and I'm putting quotation marks around all of these seems like, it seems like we have the court to make some significant advancement here. Is it the feeling of the pro-life activism community that we will get a significant rollback from this case? Are people actually hopeful that they will roll back the essence or the main thrust of Roe v. Wade?
Here's what's beautiful about what Mississippi is doing. Mississippi is strategically pushing to overturn Roe v. Wade. Mississippi has said, look, a lot has changed since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. Science has advanced, but our laws have not. So clear this up for us, Supreme Court. Can we step in and support and protect the lives of children at any point in pregnancy? And they have picked a 15-week restriction. That line is the one that they are asking about, which is very smart because, as you know, viability is an ever-changing line in prenatal development and in pregnancy. Viability was 28 weeks when Roe v. Wade was passed. It is now 21, 22 weeks. So Mississippi's law comes in before that and says, you know, what about at 15 weeks when a baby can feel pain? You know, it has fingernails and eyelashes, a heartbeat. And so we're hopeful that the Supreme Court will say, like they've done in the past, former precedent was wrong. The states can make these decisions on protecting their own citizens, both the babies and the mom. And so we at Live Action, Lila Rose, we're pointing to cases that have been thrown in the dustbin of history, Dred Scott, Plessy, Korematsu, cases where the Supreme Court said, hey, we got it wrong, and we're undoing our wrong, and we hope that happens here.
So let me ask you a couple of things. Why not start at the level of current viability if for no other reason than there might be a bit more winsome support from people that are willing to say, well, the fetus viability, that's where I'm willing to camp out on and say, okay, it's a human being. Now, please hear me, friends. Those of you listening, you know that I don't want abortion legal in any stage of the pregnancy. But I'm curious in terms of a strategic mark, why 15 weeks? It seems that it gives the opponents the ability to say, well, that's before what we know to be viable. Why would we be pushing for that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It came up on a call yesterday, Kevin, with the Attorney General's office. Attorney General Lynn Finch, by the way, is the state's first female AG, and she was discussing this 15-week abortion limit, which was passed by a female nurse. And they were saying the reason that they picked the 15-week abortion limit is a couple reasons. Number one, babies are very far developed at that point. You know, that is a 3 or 4 month pregnant woman. And that was their state's gestational age act. And so that is heading to the Supreme Court, and the court will have to decide, are pre-viability limits on abortion unconstitutional? Like you said, this is before viability, but the point of this case is to say, look, we are working to make a pre-viability limit on abortion because that's a child, and because that child is killed in abortion, and are we able to do this? And so we hope more states lead like Mississippi. This is real leadership. I mean, their brief was, you know, to adopt a basketball term for my husband, went hard in the paint against Roe v. Wade. A.G. Fitch went as far as to say, like, what you have done with Roe can never be undone. The damage can never be undone. They said it's nonsensical. It's unjust.
There's no question that the move from Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch is a bold one. But what will the court do? We'll continue our coverage with Brian Johnston of National Right to Life. He joined Craig Roberts on KFAX in San Francisco.
We're looking at a dramatic change in the court by its very nature. So that's the reason they didn't overturn Roe in 92 when they could have. In the Casey decision, they explicitly struck down entire elements of Roe's reasoning, and I'm using air quotes, reasoning, because Roe versus Wade itself doesn't make any sense. And as you know from my book, a little self-promo, but our opponents, legal advocates for abortion, have been open. And, of course, Alan Dershowitz, everybody knows Alan's name, but real leaders like Lawrence Tribe, hardcore left-wing legal advocates for abortion say, Roe v. Wade doesn't make sense. That's serious. When even, obviously, pro-lifers don't agree with it. But when the actual opponents say it doesn't make sense, you've got to look more closely. And as you know, and what my book points out, it's hidden in Doe versus Bolton. The power to kill is directly handed to the physician. They're told to abandon by Doe v. Bolton, to forget about the Hippocratic Oath. If they want to kill this baby, and if there's any reason that they can come up with, the famous health exception, the psychobabble exception, what about her psychological health? Sociological health. That's what Doe versus Bolton does. It authorizes doctors to kill. That's got to be overturned if you have any common sense or if you have any respect for the medical profession. So it's refreshing that this is coming up. It's wonderful that people now at the highest level are fighting, but this court still is determined by the Chief Justice. And in the article I wrote, again, California pro-life supporters who got their letter today, or the next couple of days, you'll get the letter. And I go into the sad history of both the court, but in particular of Chief Justice Roberts. And so we know there's numerous judges now. We have the majority of people that have in various ways said Roe versus Wade doesn't make sense and shouldn't stand. But it's going to be up to Chief Justice Roberts. He basically will use each of their opinions. And he uses these opinions like chess pieces on a board. And we saw him do that with Obamacare, where literally he moved decisions, and then his own decision he flipped in order to accomplish a specific goal. And in his mind, and he's been clear about it, his goal is to make the court look good. So that's, it sounds stunning, but that's, I guess, how some of these folks think. And so I'm guardedly optimistic, just to sum up, that this court's going to overturn Roe and Doe. Again, we need to make sure that Doe versus Bolton, which assaulted the medical profession and told healers to be killers. See, that's the real issue that came through that day. And if Roe and Doe are overturned, we're going to be looking at a new world for the United States. And many states will, at that moment, be protecting babies. But states like California, our work will just have begun.
How pivotal, in your opinion, is
Doe v. Bolton, not only in terms of abortion on demand in America, but the broader question of allowing for medical killing? And does this also potentially, if overturned, have implications at the other end of the spectrum related to things like so-called, quote-unquote, death with dignity and physician-assisted suicide?
It's definitely, let's look at it this way. Look at, if you will, again, we're in a culture that changed on the 22nd of January, 1973. Let's go to January 21st, 1973. First of all, in every state on January 21st of 73, the Hippocratic Oath was not just a casual rule of thumb. It was actually reflected in the laws of those states where medicine could not be used to intentionally kill a patient. So it's obviously against the ethics of medicine, but literally the laws of those states reflected that. And specifically in the oath, it says, and I will give no deadly medicine, even if asked. And in like manner, I will not give a woman a concoction that will cause an abortion. It says in like manner. And it's very clear. You don't have to go too far back in history books to know that common sense, even back then, millennia ago, they knew that's a human baby. That's not a little pony. That's not a little cow. That's a human baby. And doctors don't kill humans when they're most vulnerable. And when you're a baby is when you're most vulnerable. So that was in the oath. On the 22nd then, all of those states had to abandon their laws by fiat of the high court. And by virtue of that, the Hippocratic Oath as a guide for the medical profession was also thrown out. On January 21st of 73, if you had told someone, oh, you know, we're going to go down tomorrow, we're bringing my grandma down to the doctor, and we're going to put her down because we love her. We're going to bring in, it's compassionate. People would say, that's not compassion. That's killing your grandmother. That's not how you treat your grandmother. But today, I hate to say it, it's very common because we aren't using ethics to guide us. We're using emotions. And even Christians are quite free to be guided by their emotions rather than the principles of what's taking place. And so our culture was changed. And to answer your question, I believe that this will be undercut. If Roe is overturned, they're going to undercut Doe v. Bolton because they've been conjoined decisions.
Coming up, the CDC and the masking of kids.
No one within the CDC will take credit or explain their reasoning.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment, stay with us.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Follow the science. Well, that's the oft-repeated line we've probably heard throughout the course of this pandemic. But if we're following the science, kids are low risk. They're among the least likely to get COVID. If they do get COVID, they're the least likely to suffer severe ill effects. The CDC announced this week that the next school year will require masks for children again, for all students, K through 12, for the unvaccinated and for the vaccinated. Kevin McCullough turned to Bethany Mandel, a writer and mother of four, who's been covering this topic for some time. The interview took place just before the official announcement.
There is no issue that moms are more vexed about right now than the thought that their kids are going to have to go back to another school year masked up completely. In our own household, it probably cost our 8-year-old a little bit of development in terms of seeing verbal cues from teachers. But in our 6-year-old, she went from a perfect ability to speak, pronunciation, everything else, to a noted stutter in the course of 1 year that she never had any problem with before. And we firmly believe that the masking had a big role to play with it. What's your premise for the position you take in your piece?
Ultimately, it's just not necessary. We know how many kids have died of COVID. I mean, we actually don't even know how many kids have died of COVID. We know how many kids have died with COVID. It's several hundred, between 300 and 400 over the course of this entire pandemic. And every death is a tragedy, obviously, that goes without saying. I'm a parent. I get it. However, first of all, we don't know how many kids have died of COVID versus with COVID. One of the first children in Maryland, where I live, who died of COVID, was a one-year-old who was already on hospice because he had been born with all of his internal organs outside of his body. To force every single healthy child to mask makes no sense. There's never been any sort of proven studies that indicate that it is necessary or that it is even beneficial. And there was a great body of research that has mostly been unconsulted over the course of this entire pandemic about how kids learn. And I have a newborn in front of me, and one of the first things that they tell you to do about how to sort of encourage your child and talk to your child is to be expressive and to use your face in order to communicate with your child. One of my children, my seven-year-old, told me that she's been having a hard time with the masks at different classes or whatever, because not necessarily that she's having to wear it, although she also doesn't like that, but that she has a hard time reading the cues from her teachers and
right.
all of the people who are supervising her. And she says, I don't know if this person is mad at me, and it's making her extremely anxious because someone tells her, can you get down from there? And she feels really anxious because she doesn't know, is this person angry or is this person just sort of saying this? And it's hard for her to develop a relationship with someone when she doesn't understand if they're mad at her at any given moment.
No, that's the exact story of our eight-year-old. He's in that exact same boat. And he's already one that, you know, probably needed a little extra help in that regard.
Yeah.
And then the damage to our six-year-old, our baby girl, is just really discouraging. Since she's been home for the summer and been involved in camp and some other things, surprisingly, she has gotten better in a lot of respects to that. But she still is very self-conscious and very nervous when she is talking about serious things. And it's one of those things where, you know, as parents, you watched what happened and you're sitting there and you're frustrated because you know that if this was a quote-unquote more normalized existence, this stuff would be worked through much faster. And Bethany, I don't know to what degree you went into detail, but the CDC themselves have had a mixed message on masking. And I know that Carol has written about this. In many other places across the globe, most mm-hmm. countries chose not to mask kids under a certain age. I think it was under age 12. But why did we, what's the explanation as to why the CDC is now leaning towards saying we need to keep all the kids masked even down to age 2?
So that's a great question, and it's one I've actually done a lot of research into. So all of these recommendations were actually passed under the Trump administration, and I have spoken to people who were within the CDC under the Trump administration, and I've said, where did this come from? And the amount of buck passing that I heard from every single person that I spoke to, who I'm talking to all of these people off the record. I'm like, I literally just want to know whose idea was it to put a two-year-old in a mask?
Right.
That's all I want to know. I would like to know their reasoning and why it differs so drastically from the WHO, who are setting the recommendations elsewhere in the world. And no one within the CDC will take credit or explain their reasoning. There was a letter signed by 15 members of Congress that I sort of pushed through. On the Senate side, it was pushed through by Mike Lee of Utah. On the Republican side, it was a Missouri representative, Jason Smith. And they sent a letter to the CDC asking this question, and they set a deadline for their response, and the CDC ghosted them. And Smith, during a hearing, confronted the head of the CDC and said, why have you not responded to this letter? And she said, this is the first time hearing of it. I will absolutely be in touch.
Oh, come on.
Shock of all shock, they're still ghosting. They have still not responded to 15 members of Congress asking questions about where these recommendations came from and why they're in place.
Needless to say, parents are not happy. From the masking issue and reticence of the teachers' unions to resume in-person learning, to the anger and frustration over issues surrounding critical race theory, many parents are not taking it any longer. Well, here's Bob Burney from WRFD, The Word, in Columbus.
Critical race theory is nosing its way into public schools all across America, and yet one research study that I read, 70% of parents are saying, no, I don't want my kids taught critical race theory. 70%! And yet the teachers' unions are saying, we're going to teach it no matter what. In fact, some school districts, the teachers have said, we'll go to jail. We're going to teach critical race theory. We don't care. If they make it illegal, then we're willing to go to jail because it is so important to them. Add to that the failing academics in our public school systems, particularly in our urban areas, in spite of the millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars that we keep throwing at public schools, the academics continue to decline. So it's not surprising at all that I read this headline today. Homeschooling surges across U.S. even as schools plan in-person classes. Now, what has happened, at least partially? The whole COVID thing mess last year. Many, 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 many parents said, I'm not going to put up with that stuff. I've heard of homeschooling. Let's try it. Well, many liked it. And there is a huge surge in homeschooling across America. Get this, particularly in Black households. I'm quoting from a research study released today. Quote, Black households saw the largest jump. Their homeschooling rate rose from 3.3% last year to 16.1% this fall. Can you imagine? 16% of Black households across America said, we're not trusting the public schools anymore. We're gonna homeschool our kids. It's a huge explosion in homeschooling.
Coming up, the Old Testament law.
It was a good thing whose job is now done.
N.T. Wright, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment, stay with us.
Come and see. Look on this mystery.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. The Old Testament law, or the Torah, how should Christians view it today? Should we see it as relevant or binding? Or was it designed to demonstrate our inability to keep it and thus draw us to Christ? Or was it a good thing, but a good thing for its time? Jerry Bauer recently had an extended conversation with theologian N.T. Wright for his podcast, Meeting of Minds. We'll pick up with the conversation on Old Testament law.
The Torah was given for an express purpose, which was a time-limited purpose. That's the thing that it's taken theologians such a difficult time to get their heads around, so that you have the Lutherans basically saying Moses knows nothing of Christ, and you have the Reformed or the Calvinists saying, oh, no, it's all continuous. The law is fulfilled in Christ. And they both fail to see that the law is God's good law, but it was given for the time until the Messiah came. And understanding that, I hesitate to use the word dispensation because that, of course, means a lot of different things, especially in
North
America.
There's landmines everywhere, aren't there?
Exactly. But one has to pick one's way through those landmines rather carefully. And when you do, basically it makes sense. For me, the result of good exegesis is having summarized it all to say, now, if you read the text straight through, you'll see that every line just makes sense, and it means what it was meant to mean, rather than, oh, how much clearer it would have been if Paul had said X or Y.
If you read it forward as a letter,
yeah.
But
yeah.
If you go hunting, treating it as an armory,
Yeah, then, quite. Exactly. And of course, that's the part of the irony here is that people who've said the Bible have often actually treated the Bible simply as a rag bag that they can reach in and pull out a text and say, there you are, this is true for all time. And I want to say, sure, it's true for all time, but it's true in the form that God has given it to us, i.e. this specific letter of Paul to the churches in southern Turkey, probably dated 48, 49 AD. And that context is really, really important.
So you put this between the time when he has the confrontation with Peter in Antioch and then the later Council of Jerusalem in Acts when it's resolved, right?
Okay. Yes. Well, it's sort of resolved. I mean, they do a kind of a holding job, like a lot of church councils. They manage to keep people happy for the moment. And often that's the best you can do in a church council, he says, having suffered through church councils and stuff, that you have to say, okay, this is where we are at the moment. Let's hang on to one another and say our prayers and see where God is taking us forward now. And that's what they do. But yes, I've argued in my Paul biography and elsewhere that Galatians is early and that, yes, it is written before the council, so that the meeting which Paul describes in Galatians 2, 1 to 10 is not a Pauline version of Acts 15. Mm. Actually, it doesn't fit. People try to make it fit, but it really doesn't. It is Paul's more detailed account of the meeting in Acts 11, where he and Barnabas go to Jerusalem with financial help because the church is in need because of the upcoming famine and so on.
I'm just looking at the passage. There's no longer Jew or Greek. That's interesting. It's not there is or has been. Mm. We could do a perfect tense. We could do an imperfect tense. Yep. But there is no longer Jew. I think we have a present tense, but with no longer. I don't have the Greek. Maybe that's a paraphrastic or something. But
Well,
clearly something has changed. History has changed. It's not that Paul is revealing that there never should have been. It's that we're in a new time and it's not appropriate anymore.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And he says that very carefully when he's going through that the law was given to play a specific role. He calls it the paedagogos, which is a word for a male, like a babysitter almost, the slave who looks after the kid and makes sure the kid gets to school on time. He's not the one who teaches the child, the son, presumably.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that distinction.
No, a paedagogos, and this is this then plays over into the other point that I'll make about in a minute, perhaps, that a paedagogos is a slave, not a teacher, but the slave whose job it is to keep the kid by the earlobe and drag him to school, make sure he gets there without misbehaving, and then he hands him over to the real teacher. And so the Torah is given to get Israel to the finishing line, as it were, or if you like, to the starting line, to the messianic point. And once that's happened, the job is done. I use the illustration, which I've used often in lecturing, and I think students find it helpful, of the space rocket, which needs a particular booster to get it out of orbit and into deep space. Mm. I'm not sure if Richard Branson used one of those the other day when he went up, but still, you have a booster rocket because without it, you're not going to get into deep space. You'll fall back again. But once you're out there, somebody back in base presses a button and the booster rocket falls away, not because it was a bad thing and we're happy to get rid of it, but because it was a good thing whose job is now done.
For Jerry's complete conversation with N.T. Wright, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com. Jerry is having extended conversations with leading thinkers on issues that matter. I think you'll enjoy it. Coming up,
I heard the Lord's voice say, Hedia, it's me.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. It's hard to believe it, but the nation is fast approaching the 20th anniversary of 9/11. In those two decades since that horrific day, much of our foreign policy discussion has been centered around radical Islam and the threats of Islamic terror. Hadiya Miramati was part of that effort, helping our intelligence agencies understand this new threat. Her story, I think you'll agree, is captivating. Hadiya was a guest of Gino Geraci on his Crosswalk program on 94.7 The Word in Denver.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I turned to religion later in life. I was in college, and the natural fit turned out to be Islam because that's my, you know, the heritage of my family.
Sure.
And I ended up, I stumbled across a couple of extremist groups before I found the sect that I ended up in. I was a devout Muslim for about 22 years. I ended up fascinated with how the extremist interpretations of Islam were, you know, affecting Muslims in America and around the world, and then the rise of terrorism. And this all started in the mid-90s. And before you knew it, I had a career in counterterrorism. I was a federal contractor for 2 decades. At the pinnacle of my career, I was appointed to FBI headquarters, and I was developing a national program in preventing terrorism for the field offices. I decided to take my head cover off just because I felt awkward and uncomfortable. I didn't want people to prejudge who I was and what I was about. And a bunch of people just, you know, went after me. They just criticized me. They told me I would hang from my hair for an eternity in hellfire. And it just really, it's as if the veil tore, if we use a biblical example, and the religion just crumbled. It just crumbled on me. And I decided I was going to leave Islam. I hadn't met Jesus yet, but I left Islam, and I just got to a point in my life where I was just lost. I felt I had moved back to California, and I couldn't get my footing. I had a bunch of personal and professional tragedies, and then I found this pastor that I found from a tweet, and I started binge-watching his YouTube videos. So mind you, I have not set foot in a church to worship. I had no Christian friends. I am binge-watching a really charismatic pastor, and he's talking to me about Jesus. And, you know, for Muslims, we know Jesus, but Jesus is just a prophet. Of course, for them, he's not God. And then I started to get really confused. And I just found myself constantly in prayer saying to the, you know, saying to God, who are you? I just don't understand who you are. And in one of those prayers, I will never forget, as if it was just an hour ago, I heard the Lord's voice say, Hadiya, it's me. And it was the Lord Jesus Christ.
Wow.
I know it with every ounce of my being, and I just started crying, and it was the beginning of my journey to salvation.
Now, when you served with the United States Embassy in Afghanistan back in 2004, what was your sort of spiritual condition at that point?
I mean, I was a devout Muslim. I went there believing I was going to help save Afghanistan, make it a modern nation, that we were going to fight terrorism. I was specifically appointed as a political advisor to develop civil society infrastructure that would mimic Western models and help serve as a bulwark against terrorism and radical recruitment. And it was, I don't even know where to start to tell you the, it's just so unbelievably difficult to operate in Afghanistan. And that's why it's known as the graveyard of empires, because it's just, it's very, very difficult to accomplish anything. And it's not just the limitations culturally, but the security concerns make even the best of intentions impossible.
A great deal of your life has been spent trying to figure out how to both politically and socially to interact. But because of your newfound faith in Christ, how has that sort of perhaps informed or changed your approach, not just so much dealing politically or socially, but culturally and relationally with Muslim family and friends?
Oh, it's a complete 180. I tell people, I wrote one article called Hamas Needs Jesus because I had done, I mean, it was Groundhog Day. We did the same things over and over and over again, and nothing worked. And that's why I tell people, I'm like, the only true solution is accepting Christ as your Lord and Savior. And that's the great equalizer. It makes us all sons and daughters of the one holy God. And it delivers people from the bondages of oppressive religions and bad relationships and addictions. And it ultimately is the only real solution. And I know a lot of people don't accept that, but That's my hope. That's my hope, and that's my prayer for family members, loved ones, and other Muslims.
So what has been the relational fallout for this very public stand that you've taken for Jesus?
Well, my very close family member, my mother and father, have been wonderfully supportive. They love me. They just want me to be happy. They see how much transformational, like, light and joy there is in my life as a result. But I've lost friends. Mm-hmm. I've lost a lot of friends, people that treat me as if I died. And other people that, surprisingly, I've had a couple of people that reached out to me and were like, we're so proud of you. Like, that takes so much courage to do what you've done. So it's been mixed. Some people have been extremely supportive and others just written me off.
And what has it been like with your newfound family of Christians?
Amazing. Amazingly, the family of believers has been so welcoming. I mean, I would go to church. When I started to attend church, I was all by myself. Mm-hmm. And there were always people that took me under their wing, welcomed me, helped me to acclimate to the culture, to meet other families. And it's been a beautiful experience. I'm so, so grateful for the church.
How has this affected your willingness to reach out, minister, and perhaps evangelize your friends who are involved in Islam?
Well, once you accepted Christ and experienced salvation from a place from within Islam, especially when you're a practicing Muslim, the joy and the freedom is infectious. And mm-hmm. So I try to share. I tell people, I'm like, if you're going to talk to me for more than 30 seconds, you're going to hear about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So it is part of my everyday existence. I created, the Lord put on my heart to create an online ministry because it's the way I came. So you don't need to be in a physical building. You don't need to know Christians. The Lord will meet you exactly where you are. And that's just a really important theme that I try to get across.
Mm-hmm.
And I always direct people that are afraid. I mean, Muslims can be intimidated to go into a church, to listen to the online resources, find others if there's others that they're interested in, and have that experience. And me and my husband have been fortunate enough that we've had a number of Muslims listen to us on the devotional and accept Christ on
Wow.
our devotional.
Coming up?
Sometimes we get stuck on the difference between the right and the left, and it
mm-hmm.
ends up like more of a political dispute than a spiritual one.
More with Hadiya Miramati when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
This week on Meeting of Minds podcast, top New Testament scholar N.T. Wright.
Results of good exegesis is having summarized it all to say, now, if you read the text straight through, you'll see that every line just makes sense and it means what it was meant to mean, rather than, oh, how much clearer it would have been if Paul had said X or Y.
If you read it forward as a letter,
but
if you go hunting, treating it as an armory.
Exactly. And of course, that's part of the irony here, is that people who've said the Bible, the Bible, the Bible, have often actually treated the Bible simply as a rag bag that they can reach in and pull out a text and say, there you are, this is true for all time. And I want to say, sure, it's true for all time, but it's true in the form that God has given it to us, i.e. this specific letter of Paul to the churches in southern Turkey, probably mm-hmm. dated 48-49 AD. And that context is really, really important.
To hear the rest, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. How should we navigate all the issues in the broader world today and maintain an effective Christian witness to our Muslim neighbor? Hadiya Miramati is a good example, developing relationships and creating and sharing resources with a hope that friends will see the goodness of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Let's return for a few more minutes of her conversation with Geraci.
Has this actually given an opportunity to perhaps share even more enthusiastically with Muslim family and friends?
This is the very strange paradox. In the political landscape, Muslims unfortunately end up aligning with groups that are antithetical to Islam. So they end up aligning with the hard left because they think that's how political activism and getting their rights, because they fear, and for no reason, it's quite ignorant, the reasoning behind it, that they fear conservatives because they think they have nothing in common. And so they align themselves to the hard left, which principally, they have nothing in common with. So sometimes we get stuck on the difference between the right and the left, and it mm-hmm. ends up like more of a political dispute than a spiritual one. So I try to focus mostly on the spiritual issues, because there is an understanding of Jesus that is in Islam that is just wrong. And so every opportunity I get to explain that to them, and the missing piece, which is the cross, mm-hmm. the crucifixion of Christ, I get to explain that to them. I just try to plant the seed. If they don't want to accept it from me at that moment, I want to cause doubt in their minds about what they've been told about the reality of Christ, and so that they at least become seekers mm-hmm. to find out what the reality of Christ is and to understand the importance of the crucifixion. And it's the missing piece, because they accept the virgin birth, mm-hmm. they accept the ascension to heaven, they accept that he returns, but they think it was Judas on the cross, which
yes.
practically doesn't make any sense.
Yes, it doesn't make any sense. I was thinking about some of the similarities. You know, obviously God is one. Both are transcendent creators of the universe. Both are sovereign. Both are omnipotent. You would think that we would have more in common with people politically and socially from a conservative standpoint as we're trying to retain dignity, human freedom, and freedom of association.
Right. It's been a propaganda political tool that the left has used, that the Christians, they hate you, they would never accept you, they wouldn't work with you. If you've researched about the political Islamist movement, mm-hmm. there is a lot of similarities to socialism and communism. So that influence in like the Muslim Brotherhood, and that influence in their political agenda, also leads them to align with the far left.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. If you liked the program, sign up for our podcast at christianoutlook.com. And while you're at our site, remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. And never miss these and other great conversations. Thank you for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Mike Cook, and Alex Perez, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.